Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour is all about space exploration, and boy, do we have guests to support that topic. Joining us this hour is renowned plasma physicist Don Gurnett. He has a career in space exploration that spans more than 60 years in our Iowa City studio. Also with us, University of Iowa physicist Craig Kletzing. His research team just won a $115 million contract from NASA. They'll study interactions between the magnetic fields of the sun and Earth. This is a huge contract, the largest single contract won by the University of Iowa in the university's history. Don Gurnett, Craig Kletzing, sitting across from me in the studio in Iowa City. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks.
We want to invite all those interested in space exploration with questions. Space geeks, I'll just say, join us this hour with your questions for our two esteemed guests, Don Gurnett and Craig Kletzing, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Don, I'd like to focus in on you and a little bit of some of the flyover, if we could,
okay.
The way a probe might fly over a large astronomical object. Let's fly over your career. It is quite a career. You retired at the end of May 2019 after 6 decades as a student, a teacher, a researcher at the University of Iowa. I'm reading here, you've been part of 41 space missions. You were instrumental in building the UI's world-renowned physics and astronomy program. You were chiefly responsible for founding and developing the field of space plasma wave physics. We'll touch on those things, but first of all, I want to know how it all started for you at the University of Iowa. You had a meeting that proved really fortunate with a great name in space in the U.S.
Yeah, that would be James Van Allen. Actually, I arrived here at the University of Iowa in 1957. Classes used to start about in September. And just a few days after I arrived here, maybe a week and a half or so, Sputnik 1 was launched.
Mm-hmm.
You remember Sputnik 1? Are you old enough to remember?
I am. I may look that old, but I am not that old.
Right.
1958. This is October 1958, right?
October 4th of 1958.
All right.
Right.
All right.
And 1957.
Okay.
57.
57.
That was a shock to the American people because I was in the middle of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it was a pretty serious Cold War. You know, they had just, the Russians had just developed a hydrogen bomb, and, of course, they exploded an atomic bomb. And there was, a great deal of fear in the United States, people buying bomb shelters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember that whole era.
Right, and if you find a house that was built in this era, you will find it has a bomb shelter in the basement, right?
Yeah, doubles the tornado.
So, yeah, 1957, October of 1957, this is the point when this so-called space race starts, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was a space race because everybody realized that we were suddenly behind the Russians. I mean, I think that's the thing. You know, the Russians, Sputnik 1 weighed 183 pounds. About a month later, they launched Sputnik 2. It weighed 1,100 pounds and had Laika, the dog, in it. Of course, they didn't have any way of bringing the dog home. Then we had a rather pathetic situation where we tried to launch a spacecraft called Vanguard, which the Navy was developing. And it was to launch the Vanguard spacecraft, which is about the size of a grapefruit and weighed 3 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there's a famous video which you can look at. Remember Vanguard. You can go to Google and type it in.
Yep.
And you
doesn't
know,
end well.
I remember watching this on television, and, you know, it lifted off about a foot. and then back down on a launch pad and just blew up. You know, I mean, it really made the United States look pretty pathetic.
So frankly, we're really, as a nation, in a panic with this rising communist empire.
Yeah.
Feeling that we're lagging behind in space.
Yeah, that's right. And then came James Van Allen, who was working with Wernher von Braun down at the Redstone Arsenal. Von Braun, in case you don't remember, was a German rocket scientist that developed the V-2, and we got him here after the war. Somehow, I can't tell you the details of that. But he and Van Allen were conspiring, along with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory out in Pasadena, California, build a rocket that could launch a U.S. spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
And that was achieved on February 1st, 1958. It was called Explorer 1.
And Explorer 1 had an instrument aboard that was important.
Yeah, it was a Geiger tube that Van Allen had built to study cosmic rays. But he made a great discovery with that the Earth was surrounded by this intense radiation belt. Nearly deadly radiation belt. Astronauts, not even now, have to be careful not to spend too much time in that radiation.
How far up is that belt?
Well, there are two belts. There's one they call the inner one and the other the outer one. I don't know the distance in miles, but one's relatively close to the Earth and another's rather far out. Van Allen's name then was in the news all the time.
He was on the front of Time magazine.
Well, he wasn't on the Ben Kiefer show, I don't remember. And I was, you know, in high school, I don't want to go into a lot of this, but I built rockets.
Yep.
Out of saltpeter, charcoal, and sulfur.
Okay.
I'm really lucky I didn't kill myself, actually. And so I was just enthralled by this. And I was so enthralled that, as in one of these newspaper articles that's been written about me, a brilliant idea came to my mind, which was work for Van Allen. So I went over to his office, and his secretary wasn't there, but she gave me a piece of paper to write down my qualifications, which during high school I'd got quite involved in electronics. And it took a month or so, but I got a handwritten note inviting me to work in his group.
From Professor James Van Allen.
Jim Van Allen, right. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And
imagine the luck of that. Just out of high school, a man has an amazing discovery, which would later become the Van Allen radiation belt, and you on a whim.
Yeah, you have to wonder. I even wonder myself how I got into this situation. But the truth is, it was Jim Van Allen and George Ludwig from Tiffin, Iowa. George Ludwig was from Tiffin. And Van Allen was from, hope I got this right, Mount Pleasant. I've been to his home, but I can't remember the city. And it was the two of them that really built the instrument that flew on Explorer 1. So, it wasn't like I was joining a big group. In fact, the real truth is he was trying to build his group up. And Iowa just became the center of space research. Notice I left the Russians out there because on Sputnik 1, all they had was a temperature measurement, which is almost useless. So I shouldn't insult the Russians, but we really were, the University of Iowa became the center of space research, and I was right in the middle of it, right practically from the beginning. As an engineer, I was mainly doing engineering work in those days.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have to necessarily fly over your career a little in sort of quick bites here. Let's go to... would it be a good time to talk a little bit about Voyager?
That would be fine, yeah.
An instrument that you built for that.
Yep, we built, of course, I was actually project engineer on some of our early satellites. You know, like I was in charge of that here at the University of Iowa. But that eventually led to a lot of Earth orbiting satellites, which I got involved in. And then came along the opportunity to get on this spacecraft on what was called the Grand Tour. It turns out in 1977, the planets Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune were all lined up in such a way that with one spacecraft you could fly by all four of them. Not only that, you could get a gravity assist boost at each of these planets and cut down. We cut down our flight time to Neptune from about 30 years to like 12 years. And we proposed for that mission, and we got on it. And that's been a big part of my life, actually, which now in the space research business spans like 30 years.
Right. So Voyager 1 and followed by Voyager 2, both probes launched in 1977.
That's correct.
And the instrument that you helped build, you built, was on the Voyager 1?
It was on both of them.
On both of them.
We built two instruments, one on each spacecraft, and it was basically a radio instrument. We had two, like, 10-meter antennas. It was known at the time from ground measurements that Jupiter was an intense radio emitter. And people didn't really exactly know why, but they guessed it had a radiation belt like the Van Allen radiation belt. And so we wanted to measure radio emissions from these planets. Turned out later we discovered that Saturn was also an intense radio emitter. And I've sort of studied my, you know, the rotation, if you look these planets up in an astronomy book, and if you look under the rotation of these planets, so that comes from radio measurements, because as the planet rotates, the radio signal is modulated by the rotation rate. So we make some pretty important measurements there. We've discovered lightning at these planets, not only by Voyager, but some of our other spacecraft we've flown out there. And, well, we've studied lightning storms at like Saturn.
What would you say were the one or two things that the Voyager missions, and they're still out there, these probes are still out there, what Voyager 1 is the farthest man-made object from our Earth?
Well, I'd say the biggest thing we really studied was there was a theory back then that the sun, the gas flowing out from the sun called the solar wind, would eventually be stopped by the interstellar medium at a boundary we call the heliopause. And we had no idea how far out the heliopause was. And, well, in 1992, we made a radio measurement. A shock wave came out from the sun, went by our spacecraft, and then it was like several years later, I don't remember the exact number, we heard this big radio emission when I hypothesized it was when the shock wave hit the heliopause. And that turned out to be right, and we made the first credible measurement to the distance of the heliopause, which was very far out.
That's the boundary of our solar system with interstellar space?
Yeah. Of the solar system, it's a little bit tricky to say that, but it's really the gas coming out from the sun. So I have to be careful about that. The solar system, if you think of the solar system and all the planets growing around the sun, there's actually objects out there called the Kuiper Belt objects, which are even much farther out. But so it's the boundary of the gaseous envelope of the sun. And so we finally penetrated into the interstellar medium, first time spacecraft, and our instrument showed that we got there, and that was 7 years ago. And I am right now writing the results for Voyager 2, which and went through the heliopause last November. It took a while for us to collect all the data and so forth, and I'm writing the paper right now.
We're in a small room. Would either of those probes fit into this room?
They're pretty big. No, they wouldn't.
Okay. If you just joined us, Don Gurnett is with us, the University of Iowa space physicist, tremendous career, over six decades at the University of Iowa, really instrumental in building the UI's world-renowned physics and astronomy program, here with Craig Kletzing. And because Don has done so much, we have only a time to have a few highlights. He's been part of 41 space missions, nearly two-thirds of the 67 spacecraft projects the UI has been involved in. We're so pleased to have Don Gurnett with us, retired from the University of Iowa at the end of May in 2019. Craig Kletzing is with us, a professor in the University of Iowa Department of Physics and Astronomy. And as I mentioned at the top of the hour, huge news out of Craig's corner for his team. He leads a team that has won a $115 million contract from NASA. Craig, tell us, what is this contract for?
Well, it's for the Tandem Reconnection and Cusp Electrodynamics Reconnaissance Satellites. I had to practice that to say it fast.
I bet you it has a snappy acronym, though, right?
It does. Tracers. And then we...
Tracers.
You know, it's much easier to have a snappy acronym. We joke, if you don't have a good acronym, you don't get selected.
All right.
And so this is a pair of satellites that actually will be in what we call a relatively low Earth orbit, maybe about 300 miles up. But we'll be studying the process by which the sun transfers energy into this local region of space that is dominated by the Earth's magnetic field that we call our magnetosphere. And there's been a big question for a long time about that process, whether it varies in time, whether it's varying in different spatial locations. And with these two satellites, we can figure out what that is. And it's, this question's been out there for more than two decades, and people have tried to solve it and just haven't had the right configuration of spacecraft. And so tracers will make that, and we'll figure this whole thing out.
Give us a little bit of a primer on what the sun is emitting, since you're studying that interaction. We feel, of course, wonderful sunlight on a sunny day in Iowa on our planet, and that's been traveling for several minutes to get to us from the sun. But we know light, radiation, heat is reaching us. What else is being emitted from the sun that we really still have questions about that you're studying?
Well, as Don has mentioned, there's this solar wind, which is this flow of ionized gas that is electrons and protons primarily streaming out from the sun at very fast speeds. And there's not very much of it, but it's moving so fast it transfers a lot of energy. And along with that comes the magnetic field from the sun. And so when that gets to the Earth, that magnetic field of the sun and the magnetic field of the Earth interact with each other, and they connect up and allow those particles to come streaming directly in into a region we call the Earth's cusp. And that's what we're going to study with tracers, because there we can see the signatures or the pattern that this creates to determine this difference between space and time.
The Earth's cusp, where is that, or is that moving?
Well, it moves around, but it mostly is in the north and the south parts of the Earth relative to our magnetic pole. Everything we do depends upon magnetic fields. And there's one north and south, and they basically face towards the sun, but they're up at pretty high latitudes. So we did some rockets this past winter, and so we were launching out of Norway. It's that far north, launching over the archipelago of Svalbard. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where the cusp sits in sort of its nominal position for the northern cusp. And there's a southern cusp, but it's a little less accessible by things like sounding rockets. Mm-hmm. So, but our two satellites will be able to pass through this region something like nine times a day.
Mm-hmm. Does this tie in with the aurora borealis?
A piece of it actually does. There's a particular kind of aurora borealis. And I should say this is all on the day side of the Earth, not the night side. But when you're up at high latitude in wintertime, above the Arctic Circle, it's dark. And so you can see this particular kind of aurora that's red. And we think that is coupled to this process that's going on, and that's one of the things that we would like to establish with the tracers mission.
Okay, fascinating. This will be going on years into the future. Don Gurnett, with your history as a space physicist, what are you most excited about when you think about Craig Kletzing's and his team's $115 million contract from NASA?
Well, let me tell you, I'm very excited about his research, because years ago, some of the early satellites we built here at the University of Iowa were designed to study the aurora, and of course, there are still lots of questions left over about the aurora, and Craig is going after one of those questions. And I have to say about the project that he just got, I was on the Cassini mission. You might have heard about that, in orbit around Saturn. Well, we crashed Cassini into Saturn about a year ago.
It was planned to do that.
Yeah, it was planned to do that. And, of course, that ends the money stream from NASA. So we were needing a new big project, and Craig came through and got one.
And I think we can say this at this point. It's a brand new news as of today that Don Gurnett, you are instrumental in helping provide for the University of Iowa's legacy in astrophysics. Would you mind telling us what that is?
Well, okay, I guess I'll make a comment about that. I was actually somewhat worried about the continuation of space physics here at Iowa. Craig and I were getting down among the faculty to be one of the few on the faculty that actually builds instruments. And I got worrying quite a bit about that 5 or 6 years ago. And I grew up on a farm. Actually, I used to regard it as a great big huge model airplane flying field. But I decided to give that as a gift to the University of Iowa, specifically to support the space research programs, both space physics and also a space-based astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you have an announcement from the university about who was the ultimate recipient of
sitting
that.
Right next to you, Craig Kletzing. Congratulations, you are the recipient. I understand of it. Maybe you can fill us on it and then the details. An endowed professorship made possible by this contribution.
Well, thank you for the congratulations. It's really quite a great honor. The carrying this forward and making sure that our university stays the center of this kind of space-based stuff. Is, you know, one of the things that I've certainly striven towards. And so to have this named chair is really a tremendous honor. I have rather large shoes to fill, I would say.
Mm-hmm. When you hear about Don talking about, sharing your concerns about waning physics and astronomy department at the University of Iowa, what do you foresee this money will do and this project from NASA will do to turn it around?
Yeah, this gives us a big project to go forward, carries us forward for several years. And also in the last 2 or 3 years, we've been really successful at hiring some fantastic new young faculty.
We've had them on this program. I know they are. They're wonderful at explaining very sophisticated concepts to us here in Iowa Public Radio land.
One of them, Jasper Halicus, is part of our Tracers project, but also this gives us some time to let them sort of get their program spun up, get their research efforts, firmly established. And they're already proposing a way and looking for new projects and bringing them in already. So this kind of gives us a little breathing room. And I'm, very optimistic about the future.
Mm-hmm. What will we have a half a minute or so before we go to break? $115 million is a lot. What will it be going for?
Oh, it goes for everything, soup to nuts. The launch, the spacecraft, the instruments, the research, all that stuff comes out of that funding. So we have to, do everything. We buy spacecraft, and there's two of them that we have to do. So it sounds like a lot of money, but by the time you parse it all out and get all the pieces you need, we're working on a pretty tight budget.
Craig Kletzing is with us, professor in the University of Iowa Department of Physics and Astronomy. His team has just won, as I mentioned, a $115 million contract from NASA for a new project to study interactions between the magnetic fields of the sun and Earth. We'll talk about that more in detail, more aspects. And Don Gurnett as well at the table today. He retired at the end of May 2019 after 6 decades at the University of Iowa. So instrumental working with James Van Allen and making the University of Iowa a center of physics and astronomy. We'd enjoy your questions and comments for our guests this hour. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events, including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We should call it planet to planet, solar system to solar system. We're exploring space this hour with two amazing researchers here. Don Gurnett, a University of Iowa space physicist, retired in May, but still very active in space research, retired in May from the University of Iowa after 6 decades as a student, teacher, researcher. Craig Kletzing, professor in the University of Iowa Department of Physics and Astronomy. He and his team just won this huge $115 million project from NASA to study interactions between the magnetic fields of the sun and Earth, the single largest externally funded research project in the University of Iowa's history with Craig and his team. Talking about that enjoying your questions and comments, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Help us understand, growing up in Iowa, which I did, I was aware, Don and Craig, of Iowa, the University of Iowa's significance in the space program, astrophysics in this country. But explain, help us understand a little bit more about all the ways in which Iowa in the recent decades has come to really represent space exploration. Craig?
Well, one way is who my thesis advisor was for my PhD thesis. I grew up in California, not in Iowa, and went to Berkeley as an undergrad, and then I went to the University of California at San Diego as a graduate student. And the guy I worked with there was a guy named Carl McElwain. And Carl was one of the people instrumental in the Explorer 1 project of understanding that the data meant that there was a big radiation belt out there. So this is sort of my Iowa connection.
And so like Don, he worked with James Van Allen.
Very directly. In fact, there's a very famous picture that I've seen many, many times of him working with George Ludwig and Van Allen, and they're looking at the data. And it's actually, I think it's hanging up in the entranceway of Van Allen Hall.
Don Granette, part of 41 space missions. I can only sort of speculate about how many people you have worked with, trained, mentored, that are now out there working in the field.
I not only did research, building hardware and guiding spacecraft mission, but I've also been a teacher. I've been a professor. I think this is the 54th year, if I did the math right.
All right.
And that has entailed teaching a lot of classes and guiding students on their PhD theses. I think the number is 62 PhD theses and sometimes master's theses. And over these intervening years, some of those people have had great, maybe I should say all of them, but many of them had great careers in NASA, in industry, all over the country. For example, Jim Green from Burlington, Iowa. He was for 13 years, I think, the head of planetary at NASA with, a budget, I don't know how many billion-dollar budget, all those landings on the moon, and not only the moon, but Mars. And there's another student of mine, Stan Shawhan. He died quite a number of years ago, but he was director of a major program at NASA headquarters. I've got two students, maybe Craig mentioned that already, or did you, that are going to be on Craig's project.
Oh, on this team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on that team, George Hospodarsky and Steve Fuselier. Fuselier now works at Southwest Research. And I think that's part of your project, isn't it, Craig?
Yeah, absolutely. Both those two guys. And George is building one of our instruments for tracers, and Stephen is building the other one. Both have had very successful careers. Stephen is now moderately high up in the Southwest Research Institute hierarchy. I forget exactly what his title is. But both of them are significant scientific contributors to the tracers project. And I think it shows this nice continuity of how Iowa has been at the center of educating people and being involved with projects well into the future.
TRACERS is the acronym for Tandem Reconnection and Cusp Electrodynamics Reconnaissance Satellites. That's why we just say TRACERS. In actual terms of hardware, TRACERS will be what? Will it be?
It's two satellites. They're what we call small satellites these days, which means that they weigh about 400, 450 pounds, something like that, which might not sound that small, but in the satellite game, it's relatively small. And they're instruments with electric fields, magnetic fields. We're going to measure ions. We're going to measure electrons. And we're going to measure plasma waves. So it's a pretty complete little package in a small format.
If there was one holy grail of a question that you hope your project will answer, would you have that question for us right now?
That question is whether this process of energy coming in that we call magnetic reconnection or magnetic merging, whether that varies in time or space. And that's the question we're going to answer.
And why does that matter to us?
Well, we want to get ultimately to the ability to start to predict on a reasonably accurate basis what we call space weather. That is the weather of space around the Earth, because it affects things like GPS and our communication satellites. When you're watching CNN, many people don't realize that signal's coming from a satellite way out in space, and also even the electrical power grid. So if we're going to do this, we have to have good weather models like the weather forecasting on the ground. And until we know answers to questions like this, we can't basically build a good model.
Right. And those of us might not be aware of it, but these things that you're studying have impacted all of the lives of people who are listening, right? We have things that happen right on Earth because of what the sun is putting out.
Absolutely. For instance, it's several years ago now, but there was a major substation in Canada that blew up because of these effects that created a big surge of current, and it just couldn't handle it, and that was that. So that's just one effect that we see of space weather, and there's others. Communications with aircrafts and navigation can be disrupted. So there's a lot of things that we use that involve space these days that people don't even realize.
Craig Kletzing and Don Gurnett of the University of Iowa are with us talking about space exploration, how far we've come in the past decades, and where we're headed. 1-866-780-9100. Let's get to some of the big questions that are on most people's minds who are interested in space exploration. Don Gurnett, what would be at the top of your list of big unanswered questions?
Well, I think the biggest question that I can think about and have thought about quite a bit is really the search for life in the solar system. I've given quite a few talks about this subject, and probably am not well known in the scientific community about it, but nonetheless, that is one of NASA's top objectives.
Mm-hmm. How close are we? First of all, do you think there is life in our solar system that is there that just needs to be discovered?
Well, I think there's life someplace in the universe. Whether there's life in the solar system is another matter.
Outside of our planet.
Yeah, you know, we've landed on Mars, and, you know, there may be microbes deep in the interior of Mars, but there is one favorite place we'd all like to go, and that's a fairly large moon called Europa at Jupiter. And it is with the Voyager, I think Voyager we first flew by Europa, and we could see that it's covered with it's got an icy surface, complete mm-hmm. ice surface. But there's good reasons to believe that under that surface is an ocean. And so
that's liquid.
That's liquid water, almost certainly water. And that's one of the things that life seems to need is water as a solvent. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you about another place, too, which especially with Cassini that we investigated. And there's a moon at Saturn, Enceladus. And we've taken pictures of geysers coming out of Enceladus. And that means and we've flown through them, actually, with Cassini and measured what they're made of is mostly water. But they've also detected all kinds of hydrocarbons, just a whole list, almost every hydrocarbon you can think of. And now we're probably not going to go to Enceladus anytime soon. I mean, we could do it. But Europa is more accessible. It's closer to the Earth, frankly. Mm-hmm. And so the thinking is that there's probably hydrocarbons in that ocean at Europa. And my daughter does work in DNA. She's actually a neurologist. But I've had a long kind of education from her on DNA and things like that. And so I think we should go to Europa. And they believe there's geysers there. There's some evidence of that. And we should land a spacecraft under one of those geysers and have a DNA analyzer to look and see if we see anything that looks like living life like we have here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Do most astrophysicists, people who know the most about this in our country, on the planet, is this just an expectation of it will happen sometime soon?
I think there's an expectation this will happen.
So this is not a paradigm shift. This will just be in sync with what our research is leading to.
We just have to go and find out.
Technically, technically, I'm confident that we can do that. Actually, let me tell you a bit about that. To build a DNA analyzer, 20 years ago, I think it was thought to be impossible that the human genome would be analyzed. Mm-hmm. And there's a guy by the name of Craig Venter who achieved that. Incidentally, he did it with private funding, which is kind of interesting. There was a competition between government and private funding.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my daughter, who works at Washington U in St. Louis, she does lots of DNA studies, and she pointed out to me recently that you can now buy a DNA sequencer that weighs 100 grams.
So the idea would be to send a sequencer, what, to Mars, Craig, pick up there, to establish? You wouldn't need to bring it back here.
I'd send it to Europa.
Europa.
As would I. Mars is like you have to get deep in, and it's very hard to drill down.
Okay, so back to that moon of Jupiter.
Just got to get to that source of water and run it through the sequencer and see what you see. And you might not find full DNA. You might find just parts of things, but until you do it. Yeah.
Is that the search for life, life outside of our planet in the solar system? Craig, is that for you number one on the list?
I think it's a key thing we have to understand, just as a civilization, is was there life elsewhere? I mean, it sort of tells us something about our place in the entire universe.
Would that make your work different, the work of other people in research on this planet different?
It could very well. It certainly changes the way we think about how the whole universe works. I think it would confirm, particularly for people that are interested in life on other star systems, and now that we can see planets at other star systems, it would really start to lead towards, I think, a rather strong confirmation of one of my beliefs is that there clearly must be life somewhere else in our galaxy. I think it would really spur that on and looking for it in a deep and serious way. I've always been a fan of the whole idea that ultimately our civilization will travel to the stars. That's not going to happen in my lifetime, but I like to think it will happen at some point.
Craig Kletzing is with us, physics and astronomy professor at the University of Iowa. Don Gurnett, the UI space physicist. Let's go to our phones as we wrap up this conversation in the next few minutes. Dale is with us from Dubuque. Hi, Dale. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Hello. Nice to be able to speak. And congratulations to both professors for their accomplishments. I have a very brief question, and I think the concept of space weather goes with this. As I understand, the Earth's magnetic field has reversed itself way in the past eons of time, and that this cycle will continue, and someday far into the future, it will again reverse. At the time of reversal, does the Earth's magnetic field basically have zero effect on the radiation from the sun? And if that were to be the case, could our electric power grid be vulnerable to solar flares?
Okay. Well, there's a good question from Dale. Craig, do you want to tackle that one?
Well, I think, first of all, I would say we know it's reversed, but we don't know exactly how that process happens or how quickly it happens. It's a very, very hard question in what we almost think of as classical physics of how does the dynamo in the Earth that creates the magnetic field, how does this process happen? If it was very quick, it would probably have pretty minimal impact. We don't know if it takes a year, 100 years, or 500 years while this process happens. But certainly if it goes to zero, that is the magnetic field of the Earth disappears for a period of time, then we no longer have our magnetic shield, and the particles streaming from the sun will certainly come in much closer. There are suggestions, I believe, that in the past when this has happened, mutation rates may have gone up some, things of that character. And so I would say there is some degree of likelihood that it would definitely affect the electrical power grid, but it may have other more direct effects on Earth just due to the fact that this solar wind radiation can get directly to the atmosphere.
Okay, Don, you wanted to add?
Okay, I'd just make a comment to Dale. I wouldn't worry about the power grid. I'd worry about the cosmic ray flux affecting humans. Actually, that's one of the things we learned with Voyager. We can now measure the, I'll call it the primordial cosmic ray intensity out beyond the heliosphere. And it's about 10 times what it is at the present time at Earth. And the magnetic field of the Earth plays an important role in protecting us from those very energetic. You may remember when the astronauts went to the moon, they saw flashes in their eyeballs.
Mm.
Those are heavy iron cosmic rays going through your eyeball that create a flash in your eyeball.
So being an astronaut outside of our protective sphere is not exceptional for the health of a person.
I'd say that's one of the big worries about landing a human on Mars. You hear about that. That's actually labeled one of the top objectives of the U.S. space program is to send a human to Mars. But I have an old friend, Jim Traynor, who died about 20 years ago, but I remember him from one of our instruments on the Helios spacecraft saying the cosmic ray intensity that he was measuring was so high that a three-year flight to Mars would put you right at the limit of probably getting cancer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's check in with Jim calling from Spencer. Not much time, Jim. Jump in. What's your question?
I'll make it quick. There's a lot of talk today about protecting the grid from solar flares, EMPs, and I'm wondering if that can actually be accomplished.
Okay, so what is, fill us in, help us understand a little bit quickly what Jim is talking about.
So when we have a big lot of solar activity that occurs, it induces big currents up in our ionosphere, and these couple to the power grid. And as I mentioned, this caused a big explosion, basically, in Canada. People are working hard on that problem. I've been at conferences where people talk about how to do this. The effects happen so quickly that the hardest thing is balancing, protecting it quickly enough, but not getting a false detection and turning the power grid off to protect things when nothing really happens. But I can assure you the power companies all over the world that are in the regions where this can happen are working hard on this problem because they clearly recognize it as something that they want to avoid.
Mm-hmm. Is our sun in what we could solve, for all intents and purposes, a steady state for us? Is it changing? Is it increasing its radiation output? Do we expect it to in I guess, many lifetimes to come?
Over the scale of many lifetimes, I don't know that we have enough good measurements to predict that. But we certainly know that it varies over an 11-year cycle, going from what we call solar minimum to solar maximum. We're at about solar minimum now, and so we're going to be rising up, and it becomes more active. We see more sunspots and things like that as we go towards solar maximum. And so this cycle has gone on. This past cycle has actually been one of the quietest in recent history. And we just don't really have a long enough time scale. There are some measurements that go way back and understanding maybe back to people counting sunspots, but the measurements we have today just don't have a long enough period to let us say, is there a real trend over any long period of time?
Mm-hmm. We've talked about the top of your list, the big unanswered questions, but Don, perhaps when you look back over your career, your interest in space exploration, space physics for so long, you too, Craig, what have been the questions that have been answered in recent decades that have been monumental? Had we had this conversation, let's say, in 1960 or 1950, and then look at all the discoveries in astrophysics, plasma physics in the meantime, what would you put at the top of the list of discoveries that have really made our understanding what it is today?
Well, I would say radiation belts like at Earth and other planets really. Prior to Explorer 1 launch, nobody had a clue that, and they have serious consequences, especially for astronauts.
And we have, Craig, Van Allen probes out there that were launched when to study these belts?
So these were launched in 2012, almost 7 years ago. And that's because of this great interest in the radiation belts. In fact, I was going to say exactly the same thing that Don did. The radiation belts were unexpected. And maybe number two is how this bubble of magnetic field around the Earth interacts with some of the magnetic field and particles coming from the sun. And we're still learning about that, but I think that also was not clear back in the 50s that exactly how that process must go on and that it was perhaps a bit more complicated than people thought.
Mm-hmm. Don?
Let me take a little bit different angle at that is how important is the physics that we're doing?
Okay.
Now, you may or may not know that there's been a huge energy attempt to try to control fusion, essentially a hydrogen bomb that you control.
That doesn't explode, that you can...
In a power plant.
Right.
And the way to control that, the only known way, is to encapsulate this bomb, this hot plasma from a hydrogen bomb, in a magnetic bottle.
Which is the sun.
Not the sun. Okay, you could say the sun if you wish, but the Earth's magnetosphere, the radiation belt, is an exact example of that.
Okay.
So the physics, and now they've tried to do that, and here's what happens. The plasma escapes the magnetic bottle. Now, the things that I study, waves that develop in plasmas, That's what happens in a fusion machine. You put this hot plasma in there. You got to get up to 30 million degrees before you can start a fusion reaction, and it starts developing waves that scatter the particles out of the machine. And we're studying exactly that kind of process in radiation belts.
Wow. We've delved into some fascinating aspects of space exploration, space physics this hour. I'm sad to say the hour has come to an end. Don Gurnett, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on your recent retirement. Listening to you, that doesn't mean your space interest stops. That means it goes on and on, I can tell. thank you for being with us. And Craig Kletzing, thank you very much. Congratulations on your receiving that endowed professorship and on this magnificent contract with NASA to study the interactions between the magnetic fields of the sun and Earth. We appreciate you both being here, Craig and Don.
Great being here.
Yeah, I didn't get to push that last point enough. That's what plasma physics is all about.
We'll have you on again. Don Gurnett, thank you very much.
And I've written a book on plasma physics. It took me 40 years to
write. We'll get our date book out right now for that.
I'm not.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.